every family has a history. Flip through a photo album to the early years when time is measured by births, missing baby teeth, and the first days at school. Turn the page to a season of carpools and sports. It's light speed from then on out. Dating, diplomas, and weddings come front and center. By the time most parents are framing the grandkids' pictures, they've learned to savor their own family's history to appreciate what's past. Wrapped up in every family history, threaded invisibly throughout the memories, is money. That's right, money. How a family gets, grapples with, guards, and gives money is all part of who that family is. Money, in part, defines a family. And just as great memories like special events or vacations don't happen by accident, a family's view of money doesn't simply materialize out of thin air. Photo albums don't create family history or values, they chronicle them. They capture something as it happens and preserves it for others to be reminded of later. But in order to store a memory, you first have to make it. It's the role of the parents to determine the culture of a family, to decide what's worth doing, worth believing, and worth letting go. And then, if a mom and dad plan to instill certain values into their children, planting them so deeply that their children will instill them in their children, they have to be very intentional. Now, many affluent people have maintained healthy relationships with their immediate and extended families. They've also trained their children to handle money wisely. However, as we learned earlier, wealth brings with it a unique set of challenges. For the affluent, raising godly children and grandchildren is far more complex than for people with average means. Clashing attitudes about wealth, saving, and spending can make it exceedingly difficult to nurture close relationships with spouses, siblings, and in-laws. As J.S. Bryan observed, many men can make a fortune, but very few can build a family. David Johnson's banking empire was crumbling. He was forced to begin selling assets to meet obligations. One evening, he announced to his wife and two young sons that he had sold one of their five personal airplanes, the jet. James, his seven-year-old son, began weeping. When asked why he was crying, James said, "But Dad, it was our only jet." Only then did David understand the impact that his free-spending lifestyle had had on his children. Parents and teachers spend years preparing youth for occupations, but generally less than a few hours teaching them the value and use of money they'll manage during their lifetimes. Learning to handle money is a crucial part of a child's education, a part for which the parents must take primary responsibility. Proverbs 22:6 reads, "Train up a child in the way he should go. Even when he is old, he will not depart from it." Now, the fundamental strategy for training children to handle money is the little big principle found in Luke 16:10. "He who is faithful in a very little thing will also be faithful in much." In other words, as children prove to be faithful with small responsibilities, they're prepared to assume greater ones. After they handle quarters wisely, they're ready for a few dollars. When they manage a few dollars well, they're prepared for even more responsibility. Parents should be as systematic in equipping children to handle money as teachers are in equipping them to write. Children first learn the alphabet and then how to spell cat. Each year they learn more complex words and grammar, and finally they're able to write sophisticated term papers. The goal is to steadily increase responsibility so that children are independently managing all their finances, with the exception of food and shelter, by their senior year in high school. This way, parents are available to advise their children as they make financial decisions while still at home. Regardless of how much your children will receive in the future through trust funds, gifting, business ownership, or inheritance, it's essential they be trained to live within specific spending boundaries. Too many teens from affluent families have unlimited access to money or credit cards, a fact which completely defeats the effectiveness of the little big strategy. Parents need to become MVP parents. MVP is an acrostic that describes the three methods to teach children God's way of handling money: modeling, verbal communication, and practical opportunities. First, let's take a look at modeling. Since children soak up parental attitudes towards money like a sponge soaks up water, parents must model handling money God's way. Paul recognized the importance of example when he said in 1 Corinthians 11:1, "Be imitators of me, just as I also am of Christ." Luke 6:40 tells us, "Everyone, after he has been fully trained, will be like his teacher." Another way of saying this is that we reproduce what we are. Affluent parents must be careful to examine what they're communicating to their children concerning their values. This message can be confusing when lifestyles directly contradict verbal instruction. And next, the V in MVP stands for verbal communication. We must verbally instruct our children in the ways of the Lord as we go about our daily routine. In Deuteronomy 6, verses 6 and 7, the Lord charged the Israelites, "These words, which I am commanding you today, shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your sons, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up." In other words, consistently tell your children how practical biblical truths apply to everyday life, including handling money. The P in MVP stands for practical experiences. So give your children the opportunity to apply what they've heard and seen. Design experiences that are appropriate for their age and unique personality. Young children, for example, aren't yet able to grasp abstract concepts, so their practical experiences need to be tangible and easy to understand. This is especially important as our financial system becomes more and more electronic with credit card and debit cards, internet banking, and internet equity accounts and trading. Now, we all learn the most through practical experiences. According to studies, we absorb only 10% through formal training, 20% by entering into a coaching relationship, but 70% from experience and challenging assignments. What's the bottom line here? Invest your time in designing practical experiences for the younger generation. Visit chartingyourlegacy.org for some very practical suggestions. That's chartingyourlegacy.org. Next, learning money management. As soon as children are ready for school, they should begin to receive an income to manage. Parents need to decide whether the income must be earned or given as an allowance. If you choose to give an allowance, assign the children routine chores without pay as their share of the family work. If the chores aren't done, the children shouldn't receive the allowance. The amount of the income will vary according to the child's age and ability to earn. At first, of course, this will be a new experience and the child will make many mistakes. But don't hesitate to let the law of natural consequences run its course. You'll be tempted to help little Johnny when he spends all of his income the first day on an unwise purchase. Neither he nor you will like having to live the rest of the week without other things he wants or maybe even needs. But don't bail him out. His mistakes will be his best teacher. Parents should establish boundaries and offer advice on how to spend money, but children have to have the freedom of choice within those boundaries. Excessive restrictions will only reduce opportunities to learn. The first few quarters can make a lasting impression. Every Saturday, I used to bicycle to the corner store with my young son, Matthew, to buy him a pack of his favorite gum. Despite my advice, he would chew that entire pack the very first day. When he started to receive an income, we decided that Matthew should buy his own gum. And I'll never forget that pained expression on his face when he came out of the store with his very first purchase. "Daddy, this gum cost me all my money." Well, for the first time, he rationed it with tender care, and that pack of gum lasted more than a week. Now, when children start to receive an income, teach them to budget. Begin with a simple system consisting of three jars, each jar labeled separately, give, save, and spend. Children distribute a portion of their income into each jar. This establishes a basic budget using visual control, because even a six-year-old can understand when the jar's empty, there's no more money to spend. As children grow and become responsible for additional spending categories, such as school clothes and recreation, transition them to the envelope system of budgeting. They distribute their income among several different labeled envelopes, and when an envelope is empty, they have no more money to spend for that purpose. Parents of teens should require an accounting of the previous week's income before giving additional income. Training them to use a budgeting software program or an online budget such as Mint.com is essential. It's also important to teach children to become wise consumers. They need to learn shopping skills to become aware of the powerful influence of advertising and the danger of impulse spending. Next, the habit of saving should be established as soon as children receive an income. Open a savings account in the child's name. As children mature, expose them to various kinds of investments such as stocks, bonds, real estate, and teach them the benefit of compounding. Children should have both short-term and long-term saving programs. The younger the child, the more important it is to set short-term goals. To a four-year-old, a week seems like a lifetime to save for a small purchase. They won't understand saving for their future education, but will get excited about saving for a toy. It's also important to teach the cost of money and debt. Roger Getty loaned his son and his daughter money to buy bicycles. He grew up a credit agreement with a repayment schedule that included the interest charged. After the children completed the long process of paying off the loan, the family celebrated with a mortgage burning ceremony. Roger said that his children appreciated those bikes more than any of their other possessions, and they vowed to avoid debt in the future. Now, the best time to establish the habit of giving is also while children are young. Some of their giving should go to a need they can see so that they'll understand the impact of their gifts. One example would be buying food for a needy family they might know. Daryl and Kathy Heald have a passion for giving globally and wanted to pass it on to their children. They had their children decorate a large missionary jar with pictures of people from around the world, and they placed it in the kitchen. Every day, the family put their change in the jars. When they ate out, the children learned the concept of sacrificial giving by doing without a drink or dessert so the money saved could be deposited in the jar. And then when missionaries visited their home, the children could choose to give them some or all of the money collected in the jar. They learned that their giving could help people reach others for Christ throughout the world. Also, it's a great idea to take your child on a mission trip to a developing country. It's a really powerful experience. Exposure to desperate poverty can initiate a lifetime of giving to the poor. We also recommend a family time each week for dedicating that week's gifts to the Lord. Bottom line, the more involvement children have with their parents in giving, the more likely they are to develop into generous givers as adults. Parents also have the responsibility to train children in the value and dignity of work. Consider these four areas in this training. First, learning routine responsibilities. The best way for a young child to become a faithful worker is to establish the habit of daily household chores. These are chores that each member of the family is expected to perform. For example, my daughter washed the dishes and my son cleaned the kitchen floor. Next, expose your children to your work. You know, not too many years ago, most people were involved in earning the family income. Today, that's seldom the case. Even so, exposing your children to what you do on your job is important in teaching them the value of work. And if you own your own business, encourage your children to participate. One word of advice. Because most children are no longer working where their parents at work, parents' work habits around the home will be a major modeling influence. If a parent works hard at the office but complains about working at home, what's communicated to the children? Examine your work attitudes toward daily tasks at home to ensure that you're properly influencing your children. Next, encourage your children to do extra work at home to earn money. A good rule of thumb is to pay them a fair wage for the work you'd hired someone else to do. For example, if your car needs washing and your daughter needs some extra money, pay her to do it. Then be sure to have them work for others. A job gives a child an opportunity to enter into an employee-employer relationship. As children enter into high school, discontinue allowances during the summer vacation to motivate them to earn money by holding a summer job or by starting a little business. And I think it's wise for every child to experience a physically demanding job for at least one summer. I'll never forget the summer I worked at a lumber yard. 8 hours a day, lifting 40-pound bags of cement and loading trucks with lumber, all in the Florida sun, was an unforgettable learning experience. Our daughter worked as a waitress, which was a priceless education in human nature. Think about this. Teaching children the value of work builds their character. Not only do they gain more respect for the value of money and the effort required to earn it, a working child will be a more satisfied individual. I like what former President James Monroe said. The question to be asked at the end of an educational step is not what has the student learned, but what has the student become. Now, here are some other family issues to consider. First, experiencing other lifestyles. If children are constantly exposed to an affluent standard of living, wealthy neighbors, private schools, exclusive country clubs, they'll develop a distorted view of life. Parents must intentionally rupture this insulated lifestyle by involving their children with people less fortunate. Volunteering in a nursing home, participating with an inner-city ministry, or delivering food to the homebound will give children an appreciation for the financial realities of others and a more grateful heart for their own abundance. Kevin and Meg Cusack had a growing concern about the expectations that their children were developing because of their lifestyle. So to help moderate those expectations, they made some changes. The family now does all its own yard work, and they often fly coach and stay in economy motels when they travel. Well, when it comes to money, parents will frequently find themselves walking a tightrope, and keeping a balance isn't easy. Yes, we can certainly tip toward being too miserly, but more often we're overindulgent. I mean, how many of us know a father who once mowed lawns to earn a bicycle and now has a 17-year-old son driving a sports car? Overindulgence is dangerous. It saps the development of a child's character. It can destroy the need for initiative. It creates in a child an expectation to be given things without giving anything in return. Communicate that God has entrusted us with His money, that being a good steward includes guarding against waste. Teach them an attitude of gratitude by consistently expressing genuine thankfulness for all the Lord has provided. Next, one of the most critical decisions that children will ever make is the selection of a spouse. And it's important to discuss this with them. Wealth makes a young adult an extremely attractive marital prospect. Tim Case is the only child of a wealthy family, and during college, he fell in love with a classmate, Cindy, and they became engaged. It wasn't long, however, before a problem surfaced that ended the engagement. The next day, Tim's roommate overheard Cindy saying to a friend, "Ah, the breakup with Tim is no big deal. There are lots of other rich guys here to choose from." You know, some girls will attempt to trap wealthy young men in a sexual relationship. Some men are single-minded in their search for an affluent young woman to marry. So advise your children not to discuss family finances with those that they don't know really, really well. Now, here's an idea that may have fallen out of fashion, but I believe the family should be involved in the courtship. One really wise father invited his prospective son-in-law to join him on a variety of trips. business trips, missions trips, vacations. The father wanted to spend one-on-one time with him to develop a close relationship, to communicate his values, and to assess the young man. After several months, the father was satisfied the young man would be a wonderful husband for his daughter and a real asset to the family. Now, as children leave the home to marry, the role of the parent changes. No longer are the children subject to their authority. Genesis 2, verse 24 tells us, a man will leave his father and mother and be united or cleave to his wife. And during this season of life, parents should assume the role of coach, mentor, and encourager. Bev and I have thoroughly enjoyed this relationship with our children and their spouses. I believe parents earn this role by expressing love and care to their children and their spouses in thoughtful and appropriate ways. Bev has been faithful to practice Titus 2, verses 4 and 5, which says, train the younger women to love their husbands and children, to be self-controlled and pure, to be busy at home, to be kind, and to be subject to their husbands. In return, our daughter and daughter-in-law call Bev almost every day asking for advice or just because they enjoy being with each other. I focused on teaching our son-in-law and daughter-in-law how to handle money God's way. Now, here's another sensitive issue. Kevin and Jennifer question when they should disclose the extent of the assets to their children. Some trusts dictate when disclosure must occur, but when parents have flexibility, they can allow the maturity of the child to dictate the timing. Some can handle it well when they're 20. Others need more time. Some need a lot more time. This important issue really requires discernment on the part of the parents. Now, if you're a grandparent, you really have a unique opportunity to influence your grandchildren. But listen to this. It's really important for grandparents to play a complementary role in which they affirm the objectives of the parents. We recommend that the parents and grandparents schedule times together to discuss their training strategies and how the grandparents can most effectively participate. This can greatly reduce the risk of bruised relationships and ineffective training. Now, let me share my heart with you. My grandfather committed suicide when my father was only 6 years old. And until several years ago, I knew very little about his side of our family. But I was thrilled to learn that my great-grandfather was a pastor who served as a chaplain in the Civil War and later led a vibrant church. In Deuteronomy 4, verse 9, Moses wrote, only give heed to yourself, so that you do not forget the things which your eyes have seen, and they do not depart from your heart all the days of your life. But make them known to your sons, and I would say daughters, and your grandsons and granddaughters. So here's an idea you may not have considered. I strongly recommend that you write a letter, or better yet, produce a video in which you express to future generations your commitment to Christ, your life story, and the values that have shaped you. The Lord can use these in a very powerful way in the lives of those yet unborn. So encourage your children and their children, as we do ours, to continue this family tradition. Now, let's focus on what it takes to have a healthy marriage. Unfortunately, it can be a real challenge for the wealthy to enjoy a truly successful marriage. Wealth tends to breed an unhealthy sort of independence that can harm the relationship. Many people believe that they really can buy happiness, a condominium here, a boat there. So when communication breaks down or a marital conflict surfaces, the husband can leave the country to hunt and go on a safari with his friends. The wife can go to a fitness camp. Moreover, when one spouse brings a disproportionate amount of wealth into a marriage, it can present a very unusual set of challenges. This is especially true when the wife is the recipient of great wealth and the husband isn't a secure person. Because he may not be the provider for the family, he can feel that he receives less respect from his wife and children. In this circumstance, the wife needs to be particularly wise. When the husband makes a financial mistake, the wife must be careful not to say that he lost her money, it's their money. One of the most practical ways to nurture the marriage relationship is to consistently seek the advice of your spouse. Proverbs 19, verse 20 tells us, "Listen to advice and accept instruction, and in the end, you will be wise." And Proverbs 12, 15 adds, "The way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but a wise man is he who listens to counsel." If the wife brings wealth into her marriage, she must be careful not to exclude her husband from financial meetings and decisions. Instead, she should consistently communicate that the money is their money, not just hers. In some situations, a wife may highly value her father's financial wisdom if she only knew how many mistakes he really made. At the same time, however, she needs to seek her husband's counsel in such a way of expressing admiration for him. Ephesians 5, verse 33 reads, "The wife must respect her husband." I've discovered that few things undermine a husband more than the loss of his wife's admiration and respect. On the other hand, if the husband brings the wealth to the marriage, the first person he needs to consult is his wife. Frankly, it's been a humbling experience for me to seek the counsel of my wife, Bev, in financial matters because she has no formal financial training. But she's turned out to be my best and wisest counselor. Women tend to be gifted with a wonderfully sensitive and intuitive nature that's usually very accurate. Men tend to focus objectively on the facts. The husband and wife need each other to achieve the proper balance for optimal decisions. I also believe that the Lord honors the wife's office or position as helpmate to her husband. Many times the Lord communicates most clearly to the husband through his wife. So husbands, let me be blunt. Regardless of her business background or her financial aptitude or even her apparent disinterest, you must cultivate and seek your wife's counsel. The two of you should agree because both of you will experience the consequence of any decision. Even if your choice proves to be disastrous, your relationship remains intact. There's no grounds for a "I told you so" response. Now, generally, we don't recommend a prenuptial agreement. A husband and wife should be committed to one another for life, and such an agreement tends to undermine this trust relationship. However, it might be appropriate if a wealthy widow or widower with children remarry. The agreement can set forth just how the estate will be distributed, including among the children. This can help the children relate to their new stepmother or stepfather in a healthier way because it eliminates questions about their new stepparent's motives, whether the stepparent is primarily interested in the children's surviving parent or in the family's money. Relating to parents and siblings can also present a challenge for the wealthy. Kevin's father was a poor Iowa farmer. Kevin was the third of five children in a very hardworking and close-knit family. From an early age, Kevin had entrepreneurial drive. Later, he worked his way through college, majoring in computer science. After graduation, he founded a company that achieved enormous success within just a few years. It was truly a remarkable achievement, but he was completely unprepared for the reaction of his family. Some of his siblings became jealous and grew distant. They no longer felt comfortable socializing with him. Others communicated with him only when they wanted something. Kevin found himself increasingly isolated from his brothers and sisters. While on the other hand, financial resources can be a wonderful blessing to a family. For example, money can buy excellent health care and a premium education. Even so, it would be short-sighted to ignore the challenges those resources present. Here are several other common challenges. Wealthy parents who cannot so subtly pressure their children to work for the family business or involve themselves in pet projects or social organizations dear to the parent's heart. Mike and Yolanda Brown believe their marriage of 6 years was terrific, except for one painful issue. Mike's domineering parents constantly interjected themselves and their strong opinions. Even though this was a major source of stress for Yolanda, Mike was reluctant to confront his parents for fear of losing their financial help. In fact, his parents were using money as a tool to control the young couple. Mike was placing his parents above his wife, and from God's perspective, this is a mistake. Jesus Christ said in Matthew 19:5, "A man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife." When you're married, you're to leave your parents for your spouse in order to become financially, emotionally, and spiritually independent of them. Part of the reason that God made it clear that we should leave is because it forces us to mature and become more dependent upon each other and our Heavenly Father. Bald eagles spend about 2 months building a nest for the mother to incubate her eggs. When a baby eagle is born, the parents feed and care for it until it reaches about 12 weeks of age, old enough to fly. Then the mother gently nudges the young eagle out of the nest, forcing it to use its little wings. Like the eagles, parents should encourage their marriage children to transfer their dependence to the Lord and to each other. Now, this can be an emotional time for everyone. Compare life to a book with a series of chapters that we open and close as we move from one phase to another. Closing some chapters takes courage and a lot of wisdom and may even include some sorrow. In this leaving chapter, the parents' role changes to that of becoming coaches or advisors. They should allow the young couple to make their own decisions, even if the choices aren't the ones the parents would make. And by the way, this doesn't preclude the parents from offering appropriate financial help. Children, on the other hand, should continue to honor their parents and seek their counsel without remaining emotionally or financially dependent upon them. Husband and wife need to cleave to one another. In the original language, the word for cleave literally means to stick like glue. It's like two pieces of paper being glued together. You can't separate them without tearing them both. Marriage experts Don and Sally Meredith emphasize the importance of this principle. They observed, just about every marriage problem stems from either a failure to leave or a failure to cleave. It can be helpful for couples to create lists describing the good and bad of parental involvement in their marriage. Try to identify everything that might have a bearing on how completely you have made the transition from their home to your home. Now, sometimes tension between older siblings surface as one or more begin to patronize their affluent parents in order to receive a larger portion of the inheritance. Some may depend financially on their parents more than others do. They may not have cut that cord emotionally, which can result in limiting their accomplishments. In other families, one sibling may have become wealthy while the rest do not. The affluent brother or sister may have a dramatically different lifestyle. This can create jealousy and even animosity. Expectations may be difficult to manage. A sibling, for example, might ask you for a loan to purchase something that you don't think would be good for them. Or they might approach you about investing in a business opportunity that just doesn't appear wise. So each case must be judged separately. The natural instinct is to help, but we should pray and attempt to discern the best way to help. Sometimes the gift of money is the right thing to do. At other times, this may not be the Lord's will. Instead of helping your brother or sister, you could find yourself getting in the way of what God wants to accomplish in their lives. At such times, the best gift that you might give them might not be cash. You might benefit them more by helping them become better money managers or more faithful workers. A successful restaurant chain owner has a sister who lives on welfare. 3 times she's been on the verge of bankruptcy, and 3 times he's rescued her. He paid off all of her debt, purchased a debt-free home for her, and put adequate money in her savings account to provide for her needs. Less than 5 years after each bailout, she was back exactly where she started. The fact is, her real need wasn't money at all. It was knowing how to control her spending. In my experience, one of the major challenges with wealth in a family is unspoken expectations. Honest communication, difficult as that may sometimes be, is the only effective way to address expectations. So I pray that the Lord will give you wisdom on the best way for your family members to openly discuss the issues surrounding affluence. Now let's shift gears. Let's take a look at the transfer of wealth. Kevin and Jennifer Simmons had a will, but it was out of date. They realized they needed a new one and should discuss it with their children, but they were reluctant to think about the details surrounding their death. They felt intimidated by the emotions this kind of family discussion might surface, so they procrastinated. Once they understood their need to be faithful stewards in life and death, they were motivated to leave their resources in a way that would please the Lord. So, why do most affluent families struggle with matters concerning death and the transfer of wealth? Well, let's summarize some of the biggest challenges you'll face. Providing for your spouse, helping your children and grandchildren financially without harming them, managing expectations of family members, dealing with sons-in-laws, daughters-in-laws, and stepchildren, deciding what charities or ministries to support, avoiding family conflict and sibling jealousy, dealing with the reality of your death, understanding the complexities of wills, trusts, and estate taxes. Phew! No wonder people tend to procrastinate. So let's remind ourselves of these realities. First, we all die. As Isaiah told King Hezekiah in 2 Kings 20, verse 1, "Thus says the Lord, set your house in order, for you shall die." Second, we'll take nothing with us. Job said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart." And the third reality is that someone else is going to get my stuff. In Ecclesiastes 2, starting at verse 18, Solomon said, "I must leave my possessions to the man who will come after me, and who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool, yet he will have control over all the fruit of my labor." So, estate planning should be a spiritual exercise and not merely a financial or legal matter. We have to work it out in the presence of God and for His glory. What a marvelous privilege God has granted to us to select the next stewards. Looking at the big picture, you really only have three choices for the next steward. First, your heirs, and we'll discuss leaving an inheritance to them in a moment. Second, nonprofit organizations. Although tax saving is not the primary goal, it's important to remember that transferring wealth to a church or ministry could be the most tax-efficient choice. Gifts to nonprofit currently are 100% deductible from your estate, and too many affluent people have not made provision in their will to fund the work of Christ. The third choice is the government. Some people unintentionally make the government too large a beneficiary by paying estate taxes they could have avoided or at least reduced through wise tax planning. Well, what does the Bible say about leaving an inheritance? First, the Bible makes it clear that parents should leave an inheritance to their children and even their grandchildren. Proverbs 13:22 tells us, "A good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children." Then God's word issues a powerful warning in Proverbs 20, verse 21. An inheritance gained hurriedly at the beginning will not be blessed in the end. This represents one of the biggest challenges for the affluent. Henry Ford said, "Fortunes tend to self-destruction by destroying those who inherit them." Commodore Vanderbilt's grandson, heir to $60 million in 1885, observed, "Inherited wealth is as certain death to ambition as cocaine is to morality." There's sobering evidence that inheritance often hurts the recipients. Studies show that the very expectation of an inheritance diminishes personal drive, saps motivation to work, and erodes life purpose. In addition, having a reason to look forward to the death of a loved one can have a devastating spiritual impact on one's soul. However, an inheritance can be a blessing. Consider these suggestions to help ensure that the inheritance you leave for your family will be a blessing. First, train your heirs. Remember that the younger generation must develop financial wisdom before they can manage wealth. Unfortunately, some parents purposely make money mysterious or use it as a tool to control their children. You'll actually have more influence over their behavior if you teach them how and why to handle money wisely. The worst thing you can do is to transfer wealth if you haven't first transferred wisdom. Some parents have the tendency to train their sons, but not their daughters, to handle money wisely. This is also a tragic mistake. Parents must invest equal effort in training all their children. Now, let's explore intentionally designing the transfer of wealth to develop your heir's character. Some parents have designed incentives into their transfer of wealth to motivate their children to develop character, initiative, and work habits. Justin and Amy Connor crafted their wills so that each child could receive specified amounts for the down payment on their first home, matching principal prepayments the children make toward their home mortgage, startup capital in their first two business ventures, and partially matching the annual salary they earn. The children will not inherit amounts other than the ones tied to these incentives. Stan and Kay Watson decided to give each of their children their inheritance in the form of an investment in a startup business. They invested both finances and experienced counsel to assist their children. The businesses have done well, but more importantly, this has helped the children mature into remarkably responsible young people. Outstanding financial author Ron Blue recommends asking yourself three questions as you consider transferring wealth. These are great questions. First, what's the worst thing that can happen if I transfer the wealth to this person? Second, how serious is it? And lastly, how likely is it to occur? Let me repeat those questions. What's the worst thing that can happen if I transfer wealth to this person? How serious is it? How likely is it to occur? Then repeat those same questions, but from a positive perspective. What's the best thing that can happen if I transfer wealth to this person? How serious is it, and how likely is it to occur? Ask the questions for each potential recipient, whether it involves a child, grandchild, or even a charity. If you want to distribute your assets responsibly, the answers to these questions are crucial. A friend, concerned about being a good steward, questioned how much wealth to transfer to his grandchildren in comparison with what he might give to several ministries. His adult children really didn't need the money. His grandchildren, now young adults, had shown themselves to be, frankly, very irresponsible with money. So when asked the question, "What's the worst thing that can happen if you transfer wealth to your grandchildren?" he replied, "God's resources would be wasted." After reflecting for a few moments, he answered the second question, "That's very serious." And then without a moment's hesitation, he answered the third, "Knowing them, it's 100% likely to occur." Answering these questions helped him to remove a sense of false guilt and feel confident about his plans to fund the work of Christ. I like what author Russ Crossan said, "If we produce kids that are productive and content, it almost doesn't matter how much we leave them. If our children are consumptive and discontent, we won't be able to leave them enough." Well, how much should you leave your children and grandchildren? It's a huge issue. Assess how well the younger generation has been trained to handle money. Ask the three questions that Ron Blue recommends. Then pray. Seek counsel. If you're married, discuss this thoroughly with your spouse. Take whatever time is necessary for the Lord to confirm His direction. Now, affluent people have reached a wide variety of conclusions. Some have limited inheritance to college or vocational training, which is intended to equip the children to earn a living. Others have left sufficient resources to provide children with a start in life, but not so much that it will undermine hard work and character development. A minority believe that their children are wise and mature enough to trust them with large estates. Now, probably every parent of more than one child feels the same way. How can children coming from the same parents living in the same environment be so different? Then as children become adults, their values and lifestyles may diverge even more. As you contemplate choosing the next stewards of your resources, you may realize that some of your children are much better equipped to handle wealth than others, and some may have more genuine needs than others. For example, one daughter may have been divorced and left alone to raise four young children. Another daughter may own a very profitable business. Now, I'm going to say something that may rattle your cage and certainly challenge your thinking. We are to love our children equally, which often means helping them uniquely. They are unique not only in their character, values, commitment to Christ, and ability to deal with life, but also in their vocation, health, and immediate family situation. These circumstances may influence how much you plan to live to each child, and as circumstances change, you may need to adjust your plan accordingly. So what I'm saying is this. Leaving unequal amounts may be a difficult decision because it feels unfair, but we simply encourage you to ask for the Lord's guidance if you need to consider such action. Well, the first two decisions of to whom and how much pave the way for the decision of when. Many people wait until after their death to distribute their wealth. Others choose to distribute some while they are alive and the rest through a will. Consider these benefits for giving your heirs some of their inheritance while you're now living. Giving now may be more timely for their needs. Helping a young mother stay at home or enabling your children to send their kids to a Christian school may be much more beneficial than simply adding to their net worth once they're 50 or 60 years old. One of the best things about giving to your children or grandchildren is the opportunity to watch them use it to enrich their lives, an opportunity you'd miss if you waited to distribute your assets just through your estate. For example, perhaps one of your children feels called to be a missionary. Would a financial gift from you help make this a reality? Your generosity toward your children, exercised with wisdom, can open doors and alleviate financial burdens when it comes to things like starting a business or buying a first home or funding your grandchildren's college education. Also, if you want to include your children in your will but are unsure about their ability to handle money, consider giving them what I call a training inheritance while you're alive. When their four children reached their 18th birthdays, Brad and Ann gave them a small portion of their inheritance. Their goal was to find out how they would handle that small amount of money and consequently, how they would likely handle more. The children, being young and inexperienced in financial management, wasted most of the money. But they learned valuable lessons from their mistakes. So today, Brad and Ann periodically give their children money, and the children do a masterful job of handling it wisely. Brad and Ann are giving their children hands-on experience. As we observed earlier, experience is a very good teacher, but coached experience is a great teacher. In other words, experience, coupled with a mentor, is of greater benefit. And you can be comforted to know that even though mistakes will be made with the money that you provide now, those mistakes will help minimize larger ones with the amount that you leave at your death. Giving now may also reduce estate taxes. This may change, but under current tax law, you can give away tax-free $14,500 a year to as many individuals as you like. This shrinks the amount of your assets that might be subject to estate taxes. Now, here's something to carefully consider. As beneficial as current giving to your children can be, it's not always God's will for you to solve their problems with money. God may have other lessons for them, including learning to trust Him for their provision. The more you have, the more difficult it is to allow your children to learn the physical discipline that comes from suffering the consequences of their mistakes. It's so much easier for you to take away the pain. Knowing when to solve a problem with a check and when to allow God to deal with your children requires prayer and discernment. The same principles of deciding when to give apply to the work of Christ. Suppose your church or favorite ministry has a current need to complete a God-directed ministry. By waiting to give after you die, you may have missed funding the most strategic opportunity for the ministry in your lifetime. As Ron Blue recommends, do your giving while you're living so you're knowing where it's going. Now, if you're like most parents, you're not comfortable discussing wealth transfer plans with your children. Adult children are even less comfortable bringing up this issue. They may wish to help but don't want to be perceived as nosy or greedy. So how often should you review your estate plan? Experts recommend reviewing your plan every 3 years, perhaps sooner if you or your family have experienced significant changes. Keep in mind that wealth transfer plans represent a process. As circumstances change, as ministry opportunities change, as tax laws change, and as you learn new information, you'll want to review your plan. One final thought, and it's an important one. The first steps to take are to decide how you want to distribute your assets and how to prepare your heirs for what they will receive. Then, and only then, should you engage estate professionals to draw up the documents after you've made those basic decisions. Don't do it the other way around because the professional may not clearly understand what you really want to accomplish. Most estate attorneys are trained to pass on as much money as possible to the next generation without considering the spiritual impact on the heirs. Remember, it's an awesome privilege the Lord has given you to select the next stewards of the assets entrusted to you. I love what Dietrich Bonhoeffer once said. It is a righteous man who lives for the next generation. Well, may we be faithful to equip the next generation well to handle the resources that we entrust to their care.